Not a lot of folks know this, but a couple years ago, I made an interesting decision to pay closer attention to mixed martial arts. Prior to that, I never watched sports, except for a handful of UFC fighters like Anderson Silva and Chuck Liddell, and the obligatory Manny Pacquiao fights and some Filipino. Aside from those few and far between moments, I just never got into watching sports. When I made the commitment to pay attention to MMA, I was surprised to learn how deep of a rabbit hole combat sports went. For most casual fans, MMA is seen as a brutal sport where two people try to punch each other's heads off. And that's where my level of understanding was. As the years went on and I stuck with it and I kept watching fights, I gained a deeper understanding of not just the fight game, but the politics of the sport, the relationship between fighters and the media, and the never-ending debates you can have with other MMA fans. And I gotta say, I'm so glad I invested that time to understand the sport, and it's taught me to appreciate the knowledge that other sports fans have. Speaking of knowledge and sports, today's guest is the perfect person for me to talk to because he's been a lifelong fan of the NFL. Ricardo Wolfolk Jr. is the host of the Home Cooking Sports Podcast, and today we spoke about whether or not Colin Kaepernick's protests have made a large enough dent in the NFL, the high risk and high reward lifestyle of an NFL player, and the need for more black sports commentators like Ricardo himself. I'm sure all you sports fans will love today's show, so kick back in that lazy boy, grab a cold beer, dig into a plate of buffalo wings, and tune in to another installment of Lag Radio. Okay. All right. So you were saying that, you know, you've had this lifelong interest and passion in football, but I know that you've also said that you currently have this love-hate relationship with the NFL. Like, why is that? How come your sort of relationship with it changed?
So I would say there's no getting around social issues, politics, and sports. At this point now, everything is meshed together.
Intertwined, yeah.
And I just felt like growing up playing football, family playing football, watching football, and seeing, you know, everybody knows that, especially the NFL, it's a sport that is, you know, primarily dominated by black men. I just felt like even if you don't really agree with a lot of the social issues, like from a fan standpoint, that I just felt like at some point there was like a lot of disrespect. So, you know, these guys, you know, make up a majority of your skill positions. These guys make up a majority of your talent base, and it's just not. It was almost like a. It wasn't even an acknowledgement. Like, okay, there is a problem. For me, I'm willing to listen to people who say, you know, I hear what the guys are protesting about, but you know, I don't think this is the time to do it. I may not agree with that, but I could kind of see where you're coming from. But when people were acting like, you know, they're just making trouble and they don't understand why they were protesting, that's when I was like, okay, now it's becoming disrespect because you know what's going on out here. And that was my love hate thing. And I wasn't surprised by how the owners reacted to it. My thing was, it was just like, okay, you cheer these guys on Sundays because they're helping your team win. But when you pull back the curtain and then they're saying, you know, this is going on, I'm really concerned about it, and then you do a 360 on them and say, you know, I don't even want to hear what you're saying. It's like that doesn't even make sense. Like, you want me to go, you want these players to go out and put their bodies on the line for your team, but then if they're saying, hey, you know, there's problems in my community, or there's problems with black men who look like me getting killed. It's like, no, let's not hear about that. Go out and play. Like, that's the problem
So,
I had.
right now, where would you say the state of the NFL and its relationship with the team owners and the players? Like, where is it right now? What do the players want, and what is the conflict going on right now? Because I know that this, you know, really kicked off when Kaepernick started his protest.
Right.
But I'm not, I don't really follow NFL. I'm more of a, boxing, martial arts type of dude. But I know that there's levels to this, and I know that especially for people who are really into the NFL, like there's layers and nuances, and there's, so where are we right now, and how's everything going?
I think right now, because it's been 3 years, a little over 3 years since, the protest started, a lot of people, I could just go by myself and my immediate circle. I will say this, they're not watching as many games as they did previously, but at the same time, they're like, okay, this whole Kaepernick thing, they look at it as, I can support Kaepernick and what he stands for, but I can still watch on Sundays. And some people may look at it as a contradiction, but I think once the people who kneel with Kaepernick, like Eric Reid and Kenny Stills, once they got on teams and they said that they were still going to play, I think it kind of not really eased the tensions, but more or less like the conflict that I felt and other people felt, it kind of eased it a little bit, where it was like, okay, let's, these guys are playing. Okay, we understand that, but at the same time, what can we do outside of football? So if that's even donating to Kaepernick's foundation, or if it's just as simple as, you know what, I'm a volunteer, my time at, local boys and girls clubs, or I'm gonna get involved. I know a lot of people who, after the protest, they've got involved into their local politics. They've gotten involved in it. So honestly, I will say that for those who are still watching, a lot of people that I know are doing things outside of it. And I think that was just because they felt like, okay, I got to do something. I can't just act like this whole thing didn't happen.
Yeah, they want to be able to get like actually take that protest and put into action and
And I, but one organization, like sports organization, well, I guess entity you can call it, that I still don't support is the NCAA. Because my thing is, like, I know a lot of the players come from the NCAA, but I just feel like until they start paying players what they deserve for what they do as far as their product, I won't be able to support it. I did, I love the legislation that came out of California with be able to make money off your likeness, but these players need some type of stipend or whatever you want to call it, as much money as they're making.
Yeah, so I and that's another thing that it's so wild to think about, like how much money college sports. I mean, I live in Texas, and coming from California, where we have like no, like the Bay Area, where we have like no football spirit aside from some people in San Francisco. Texas, it's like the football culture is really deep, and like you go to a restaurant and they have like jerseys of like the high school players, and
It's
I've
religion.
never yeah and I've never been in a place like that. But still there's this weird mentality that even among Texans that like if you go to college for sports that you don't have to get paid for that, which is I think the thing that shocked me the most was like as much as this industry is making billions of dollars, a lot of these players are struggling just to be able to eat because there's so many complications with them getting paid and accepting money and whatnot. So like where are we right now in terms of making progress on this, and like how bad is this problem?
If you're playing basketball, there are so many different avenues you can take. One is a few guys, instead of going to college, they've gone overseas to play basketball because they'll be getting money. And a lot of times they get, they're pretty good contracts, to play in like European countries and things like that. I think what's the kid's name? LaMelo Ball, from the Ball family. He is playing in Australia right now, and he's projected to be the number one pick. He decided, to forego college because he wants to get paid. But as far as like all the players that go, it's still this thing where they're going for 1 year, and if they're good enough to get drafted, then they're just taking that 1 year in college and then moving on to the next the next level.
Uh-huh.
What a lot of these players are doing is they're taking out insurance policies when they're in college because for the future money that they're going to earn.
Correct.
The NBA, I want to say in either 2022 or 2023, they are going to go back to, if you're 18 years old and you graduate high school, that you can come straight to the NBA. They're going back to from the high school to the pros.
Wow.
Because what's happening is these kids that are good enough to come from the high school to the pros, they're forced to do at least 1 year in college. And sometimes, the risk of injury, they'll get hurt and then it hurts their NBA draft stock. Or they come to the NBA and they still have a lingering injury. Zion Williamson, he was the big talk of college basketball all of last year. He hasn't played a game in the NBA yet because he's had this lingering knee injury from
Wow.
when he got hurt in college. And he could have gotten hurt. The same, he could have the same type of injury when he was in the NBA, but it's a simple fact that, and he was ready to go maybe even 10th or 11th grade. Like he was like LeBron size in high school.
Wow, so it's like lifetime player, like already advanced at a very young
Yeah,
age.
he was ready to go. And I mean, I understand you have to be 18, but I mean, like I said, at 17, 16, 17, he was probably ready to go. But I feel like, if you get hurt in the NBA your first year, then of course you still get your money. But when he was in college, he hadn't gotten money yet. Of course, he had an insurance policy, but it's not the same. And I just feel like it's not fair to tell a 18-year-old kid that's ready to go, who everybody knows he's good enough to go, to say, you can't do this. You have to go to college for 1 year. I mean, a lot of these guys, they like the experience, but I mean, let's be real. I mean, where a lot of these guys are coming from as far as their economic situation, like you're telling me I have to wait a year to get, $12, $15 million guaranteed. And to me, that's just not right. As long as you're 18, you should be able to go.
I'm always so it sometimes concerns me, at least being in Texas, and I see how much sports is pushed as, a viable option for like a career, and a lot of people get into it. But the relative percentage of people who go pro and the people who, not even just go pro, but people who actually make money that will last and sustain, I always think about the how temporary some of these careers can be, and how, you can have this prodigy who has been working at this thing for his whole entire life, and then, like you said, like boom, like one injury. How do you feel about these types of career paths, and like, do you think that there are better ways to structure this so that a lot of the athletes who go into this, don't feel like it's this, oh, I have like this flash in the pan, I need to make as much money as possible and then like get out of it. Like, is there a way to make this more sustainable? Is there a way to make this so, they're not struggling through this whole entire thing, and they have to go through this lottery? Like, what other options are there?
I think that's where the paying the college player thing comes into the effect because, if I'm if I'm a if I'm good enough to make it to college, a lot of these guys know, once they get in, whether they're going to the NBA or not. So, but if I'm able to make, a sustainable amount of money based on that, I can, continue my education, but also I can have money to, feed my family. Because a lot of these kids, they are the once they get to the league, they are the primary breadwinners, for not just their immediate family, but a lot of times they're taking care of
Extended family.
extended family, aunts, cousins, grandmothers, etc. But I will say, I think letting these players know that, I think more minor league type things, like the NBA has what they call the G League, which is for, players who are undrafted, but they still have a chance to make some type of money. And like I said, going overseas. But while these guys are in high school, especially a lot of these AAU guys, they're going to these top high schools where, they're private schools and they're making, the private schools even making money off these kids' athletics. have these kids enroll in, like, physical training courses and sports medicine courses. And I mean, they can, that way they can stay around the game, even if they don't, they don't make it,
Like, even if they're not playing.
Right. Yeah. Sports and conditioning guys. I mean, those are solid careers. Like, guys who, team doctors or, team physician assistants, those guys make really good money.
Money. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you still get to travel with the team. You still get to, to a certain extent, experience being, a player, but like a trainer, like when Michael Jordan played, like, I forgot how much money he made, but the guy who was Michael Jordan's trainer, I mean, he was making millions. And so, and nobody knows his name, and he'll he could walk by and nobody really knows.
Oh, that's like the best kind of money. It's like money that you have that, like, no one knows, no one bothers you about it.
So I think pushing these kids into, the medical side of sports. Also, now the big thing is analytics, especially in the NBA, analytics. Push these kids and look at analytics, and I would say kind of just education, because there's so much. Also,
So when you talk about analytics, like, what kind of jobs would that be? What would that entail?
I mean, they have guys who they can track how fast, guys are running, like the sports science side of it.
Okay.
I'm going to say the NBA. I'm not 100% sure about the NFL, but I know for sure the NBA has it where they put like a small little chip in the jerseys, and you can see how fast the guy's going, and the speed, and especially NFL, they like to read like a guy. So if a guy runs for a long touchdown, they'll say, he ran 18 miles per hour
on this touchdown. So just like getting into the data of like how fast and sort of like the specific metrics of how well they're doing and whatnot.
Right. And that was a part of the Golden State Warriors' success. They were one of the first teams to kind of embrace the whole analytics thing. And they were just, their whole thing was, hey, shooting more threes versus the twos, the outcome is really not as, any different. Mm-hmm. So they're like, it's more beneficial if we take more threes than driving for a layup. Because the percentage of missing that shot is about the same.
Oh, okay. So they're using the data to reinforce like the strategy and like alter how they actually play the game.
Yeah. And in the NFL, the Baltimore Ravens, they are one of the best teams, probably the best, top two teams in the NFL right now. And what they have started doing is they're going for more on fourth down, meaning instead of punting the ball, they're trying to pick up the first down. Mm-hmm. So they have an analytics team who basically came to them and said, look, there is the same percentage. Like, there's really not much of a risk, because it was always taught, with football, on fourth and one, fourth and two, unless you have a really, really, really good running game or a really good offense, you need to punt the ball. Mm-hmm. But now they're like, they think they have a great offense, which they do, but it's also like, look, I mean, if it's fourth and three, we don't want to punt the ball. We don't want to give it up. So I think it was something like you have a 48% chance of picking up a first down versus if you punt it. So now they're like, they're going with the analytics, and they've been one of the most successful teams this year for picking up first downs.
Wow.
When they have fourth down, because I mean, they're extremely aggressive and they don't punt the ball a lot because they're continuously going for it.
Yeah. That kind of reminds me of, I've been following like the UFC for, I don't know how long, since I was like in high school. And I've noticed that over time, the training facilities have gotten a lot more complex, and they've introduced a lot more sports scientists who are like measuring the force of each punch and measuring like the angle and the optimal angle. And like training now is just so intricate. And like you can get super, super, like it looks like it's something straight out of a movie. Like you have people like, hooked up to different wires and measuring all these different things. And like, I feel complicated about it. Cause on one hand, it's like how much can you refine? How much can you improve and enhance the human body to be able to do these already complex feats?
Right.
Yeah. It just seems like sports is like with the integration of science and sports have just gotten so much more intricate over time.
Yeah, I mean, with the internet, so it's like it's so much more information out there, and this information, is so accessible now. So I mean, these teams, they're thinking, like, the teams that are thinking years ahead are the teams right now who are successful and who are winning. And that goes back to, the analytics, the training. I mean, so the sports science. I mean, they can say hook a guy up and, see how fast he runs, straight incline, all that type of stuff. How long it takes him to be fatigued, at before a certain time. I mean, all this stuff is all being packed in. And it's funny because, like, I mean, what, 20 years ago, it was like, oh, there's always athletes versus, like, the scientists, and and they were kind of like on opposite ends. And now, like I said, everything is starting to mesh together, where they're going to these guys for, information, and then a lot of these athletes are starting to, get different nutritional plans to, recover faster, after, after a game. Like, their recovery, that's their big thing, and they're changing their diets now, so they'd be able to run faster. And I think a lot of, especially NFL players, looked at how Tom Brady has, continues to play into his 40s, and I think they kind of looked at him and trying to figure out what he's done. And then LeBron James is another one. He's a guy who, he's, I mean, the way he exercises and what he does, he sleeps 12 hours a day,
Whoa.
which is pretty interesting, and that helps his body recover. So, I mean, all that information is out there, and these guys are hiring scientists, and the teams are hiring these scientists and nutritionists, so to try to get success.
And I was, I was thinking about it, and I was wondering, are we gonna get to a point where the athletes who can perform significantly better are the ones who are financially more advantaged, who can hire these trainers and hire these nutritionists? Because, the discrepancy in pay, like for fighters, is incredible. Like, you can have a fighter who's getting paid 500,000 and one who's getting paid 20,000. And obviously, the one who's getting paid 20,000 isn't going to be able to go ahead and hire the most fancy coaches and be able to go to cryotherapy and all that. How do you feel about the cost to, play at a high level, juxtaposed with the fact that a lot of people who get into sports oftentimes come from very disadvantaged backgrounds?
I think with most things in our society, there are going to be people who have one, two, three legs up, and there are going to be people who have to fight and claw for everything. So I just think that it, for me, it's tough, because you have players like I was mentioning, LeBron James, where, he was just born, like, physically gifted. Like, at his height and weight, there's no reason why he should be able to run that fast and jump that high. That's just what it is. But then you got people who, put in the work, who are, overlooked, and eventually just kind of built their way up. And I can say Steph Curry is one of those guys, because he was always viewed as undersized. But at the same time, his father was an NBA player, so he kind of, knew about training, and he was grew up around basketball players pretty much all his life. But I think a great example of a player like that is, he plays for the Portland Trail Blazers, CJ McCollum. He has a very interesting story, where he was extremely undersized at 15. I want to say he was about 5'9", but he just kept working, and he was the smallest guy out there, but he just kept playing. And then he hit his growth spurt, went to a small, like a smaller school, and when he got to the NCAA tournament, played extremely well, draft stock shot up, and now he just signed it, not last year, but the year before, he signed a max contract, almost close to, like, 180 something million dollars. So it's one of those things where When I see how much guys get paid, I've never been the type of person to like, because there are a lot of fans who say, oh, they don't deserve that type of money. They don't do that type of money. As long as the organization you're playing for is raking in billions a year, I just feel like if you're at the top of your game and you get a signed $100 million contract, you earned it. I think it's just one of those things where it's, you know, somebody's always going to have $1 million, and there's also going to be someone who has $5,000, and that's unfortunately is what
It
it
is what it
is.
is.
It's sports, and it's I don't
And
know.
that's actually that seems like it's such a common thread. It's like one of the things that I think is interesting about a lot of different sports organizations, whether you're talking about the NFL or whether you're talking about boxing, once you get to the high levels of like the people who are actually organizing these things, the people who are actually in charge, I mean, you're talking about so much money and there's so much involved, and like there's then conversations about like, okay, like are there certain people pulling strings? Like, are there certain reasons why some people get drafted or some people succeed, or like did someone, you know, take the fall to, you know, did someone get paid off to do some of these things? Like, and I know that MMA has definitely been criticized for a lot of those factors. In your experience, having watched sports and you understand the business side of it, is that a thing? Like, are there, is there, you know, hands behind the curtain who are pulling strings? Like, are there any forces that make an impact on who succeeds and who doesn't?
Absolutely. Especially in the high school and college game.
Oh, okay.
Boosters, hands under the table. There was a story about a player for the University of Memphis. So, Penny Hardaway, which he's a retired NBA player, that's the school that he went to. So, this kid that he, I'm gonna say, kid, he has to be like at least 17, 18. A few years back, he helped this kid and his and the kid's mom with, to move them into a better area in Memphis, Tennessee area. This was before he became the coach of University of Memphis, but the kid was playing on an AAU team that, that Penny Hardaway was familiar with and was friends with the coaches. Fast forward, this kid remembers Penny. He helped my mom out. He was always around. He helped out my AAU team. He's the coach of University of Memphis now. I don't really the kids think I don't really got to go that far to play college basketball. Penny's a great guy. I'm gonna go play for him. So NCAA says, well, finds out about the money that was given to the kid. So they suspend the kid and make and this ridiculous thing where they're saying that the kid has to pay the money back. And it's just like, yeah, so it's the story has been not really swept under the rug, but no one's really talking about it right now. But I guarantee when this kid goes to the NBA, they're going to bring it back up. But it's just the ridiculousness of the NCAA. And for them to punish this kid when they know all of these backroom deals that are going on, and a lot of times it's the big corporations, it's the Adidas, it's the Nikes.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they whenever you see a highly recruited high school football or basketball player go to a school that's not like the big power name schools, a lot of times it was some type of money that was paid that doesn't really come out. There's been so many scandals with the NCAA. I think about Reggie Bush when he played for USC, and after he was drafted by the New Orleans Saints, it came out that his family took money for him to go to USC, and some of his relatives got a job at USC. Those type of things happen all the time, and I think for the NCAA to act like, they're coming down hard on this type of stuff, it's just like, no man, it happens all the time. If you watch sports, you know that it's a dirty game.
So
It
what
can
do you
be a
think
dirty
is
game.
the incentive of these brands and these boosters to like not have like for these athletes to not get paid? Like why would they want him to pay that money back? Like why is there this concern that it's almost as if like these organizations are concerned of player autonomy. Like they don't want them to be able to make their own decisions or be able to have decisions that are like independent. I don't remember the name, but I remember hearing something about like, you know, college football players, you know, not being able to even accept money from like parents or suffer food. Like it's just like they're incredibly strict about them being able to not. Like they have to, it's almost as if they have to use everything that's in the facility.
That's
They.
it. I think it all honestly, I think it all comes down to control. They want to be able to control everything that these kids do. And it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I will say, just as a fan, race has a lot to do with it. I just think they don't want the kid that like really figures it out and you know says, you know, well, if I go to this school versus this school, they're offering me this. They're already telling me I have to go to college. So I'm gonna go to this school where they've told me, hey, we'll give your family $50,000. I'm only gonna be there for a year. 'Cause they've already I'm already projected to go to the NBA. So I'm a you know, go do my year, get to the NBA. By the time all this comes out, if they do find out, I'm already in the NBA. I don't get punished. The school gets punished, but I don't get punished. These big corporations like, you know, like Nike and Reebok and Adidas, I think they just because they know the power of their brands. A lot of these kids will pick certain colleges because they know, oh, this college, they're sponsored by Nike. So when I go, I may not get money,
But I'm
but
gonna
I'm
have
gonna
my
get
foot in the door and
I'm gonna get all the Nike shoes I want, all the Nike apparel I want. And then if I do make it to the NBA, I've already went to a Nike school. A school is sponsored by Nike, so I may even get a Nike shoe contract. Like, I mean, it's no coincidence that Zion Williamson went to Duke University, and you know, it's a Nike school. It's all about exposure, because the Nike, you know, Nike sponsors them, so Nike sends them two or three pairs of shoes a game, and they get free apparel and all that good stuff.
And it's almost like the this whole entire industry creates this type of mentality where like people feel like they have to like they can't necessarily make the best decision in terms of like what I want and what's best for the longevity of my career. They have to think of like you know, who knows how long I'm going to be able to do this. I just need to make as much money as possible because you know, once I'm gone, like that's it, right? So, another thing that you wanted to go ahead and sort of shed some light on, and something that I actually don't really know too well, is the situation going on with Michael Vick. I know that a lot of people understand the, you know, the origins of how he got into this whole mess, but what's going on right now, and you know, what's your take?
So the NFL has their Pro Bowl every year after the Super Bowl, was basically the All-Star game for the NFL. So all the you know best players that get voted for the All-Star games, they all come together and they have you know a big game exhibition, what have you. So what they've done in the last few years is they vote for or they get honorary captains for the opposing teams. So usually like a Hall of Fame player. So Michael Vick is one of the honorary NFL decides to make him one of the honorary captains slash coaches for one of the Pro Bowl teams. Once that news was announced, not too soon after, a petition went out with people who said that because of Michael Vick's past with the dog fight and everything, he shouldn't be allowed to coach or, coach, or he shouldn't be, in their words, he shouldn't be honored as an honorary captain for one of the Pro Bowl teams. So it's now it's NFL fans or Mike Vick fans versus, fans of, I can't really say fans of animals because, I mean, anybody who has half a brain knows what Michael Vick did was wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But he
Do you think that this criticism is coming from someplace else?
Yeah. I mean, because as many people have brought up in the past, even before this came up, like after Michael Vick was released and there was petitions that people didn't want him to be able to play football again. Mm-hmm. It's like, look at the different charges that a lot of these players get. I mean, you can physically assault a woman and still play every Sunday.
Yeah, there's like a bunch of dudes who've like been caught with like domestic violence and shit. They're still being able to play.
I mean, domestic violence. There was a player who was drunk driving 1 year and accidentally killed somebody. And he was signed to a team. He didn't get a chance to play because I think mentally he just wasn't in a good space. Mm-hmm. But it's just like you have that. And for me, I'm sorry, I would never let go of the whole Ben Roethlisberger situation.
What happened with that? I'm not too familiar.
So he was arrested, but he was never charged with sexual assault. And according to the woman, he kind of, forced her into a bathroom at a bar. His security kind of stood in front of the door so no one else can be in, could come in and assault her. Mm-hmm. They settled out of court. The NFL suspended Ben Roethlisberger, I want to say 4 games. Between 2 and 4 games, he was suspended.
So it's like a slap in the wrist, basically.
Right. And it never gets brought up. Michael Vick's, when he did go to jail and everything, it seemed like every few years it keeps getting brought up and brought up and brought up.
So you feel like the...
And that was...
Do you feel like in this case it falls along racial lines that black athletes who get caught for something, it sticks to their profile a lot longer than if they're, sort of, say, for example, a white athlete?
Yeah. I mean, it's like with Michael Vick, he can never live it down.
Yeah.
He's donated money to animal rights organizations. I mean, of course he's remorseful, but my biggest thing is he went to jail. He did his time. Mm-hmm. He literally had to work his way back because when he went to jail, he had no more. He had to sell his houses for legal fees. Mm-hmm. He couldn't get any money. When he went back into the NFL, he played well. And Michael Vick was a fan favorite. I mean, even if you really didn't watch the NFL, a lot of people knew who Michael Vick was. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing Michael Vick Atlanta Falcons jerseys where I grew up in Maryland, mm-hmm. when nobody liked the Atlanta Falcons, but
he's a big name. I remember my brother, he was into football and he used to talk about Michael Vick too.
Michael Vick. I mean, he was honestly, like from an athletic point of view, he was probably one of the most athletic guys to ever play in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And so I just feel like they just can't let it go. But the NFL has already come out and said, they're not listening to any of that. He is going to be an honorary Pro Bowl captain and coach. I mean, unfortunately, they have guys in the NFL, Hall of Famers and legends who have done some awful things off the field.
Mm-hmm.
Was really not really funny, but what's really interesting to me is, I mean, Lawrence Taylor, he's had multiple like sexual assault things and lewd and indecent conduct with a minor. He had that a few years ago, and
he's still playing.
He's not playing, but the NFL has been celebrating their 100th season, mm-hmm. so they have the honorary players, and he deserves to be on the list, but they actually put him on the show when they're talking about it. I'm like, that's not a good look.
Oh, like, damn. They,
if they're going to distance themselves from certain players, he's one of them that I would distance myself from. There's no doubt what he did on the field. He's one of the best players I ever played, but you don't put him on TV and have him talk about it. It to me is just a bad look.
Like, it's like they're blatantly ignoring.
Yeah, they're ignoring. Like, they ignore when it comes to, seems like when it comes to violent offenses against women, the NFL will turn a blind eye. A lot of times their fans turn a blind eye, because a lot of these players, you know, you look on TV and they're scoring touchdowns, and then it's like, unless you really know, then you wouldn't think that, you know, you wouldn't think that these guys would do stuff like that. But they're at least four or five guys has played this Sunday who, if you look at what they did, is like their criminal past. It's just like it's ridiculous.
Damn. In terms of this discrepancy in the treatment of black athletes versus white athletes, another thing that you've also sort of touched base on that you're passionate about is the discrepancy between having black sports commentators and having black voices who are sort of on the side of like the entertainment aspect and being able to host all these different shows on ESPN and all these different networks. How do you feel about that? I know that like the industry, like the whole entire football industry is massive, you know, from the journalistic perspective to the entertainment aspect. And you've mentioned about how the NFL is comprised of a lot of black men athletes, but what's your take on the other side of the business?
Yeah, well, with sports commentators, I feel like there are some black sports commentators, but what I feel like the big sports stations, what they like to promote is a person that's not going to really challenge the NFL on their policies. When the whole, you know, controversy with Kaepernick getting a workout, and Kaepernick saying, you know, basically not agreeing with what the NFL wants to do. The NFL wanted him to sign a waiver, basically saying, if you decide to work out, you sign this waiver, you cannot sue us if no team signs you. And Kaepernick and his lawyers decided that that wasn't a good idea because of, you know, Kaepernick already had his settlement with the collusion, but now they're saying any future lawsuits, you will no longer be able to do this if you decide to sign this waiver. So he refused to do that. Also, they wanted to him to have a workout in Atlanta Falcons facility with no cameras or media are allowed. Kaepernick was, they don't want to agree to that. He wanted cameras to be there so people could see, so they couldn't spin the narrative.
So I guess I'm kind of confused. So the whole process of him working out, like what is his goal? What does he want to get out of this workout? And what does the NFL want? Like, why? I was so confused about, you know, the controversy about this.
The NFL, their motivations behind it, it still hasn't become clear. At one point they were saying Jay-Z was behind it and it was pushing the NFL to do this. I personally believe that that's true. To me, it sounds like Kaepernick has been, and his lawyers and his team have been contacting the NFL, and I believe that Kaepernick still wants to play. I just feel like the NFL wants him to play on their terms, and he wants to be able to play on his terms.
And what are those terms?
His terms with the workout was he wanted media to be there because he felt like he doesn't trust the NFL. Well, if he went and worked out behind closed doors and there were no cameras there, I think he felt like the NFL could spin it any way they want. Like, oh, he didn't really look that good. That's why we're not going to sign him. You know, he still can't throw, but his thing was, let's cameras there so I can show you I can still throw. So now any excuse for why I'm not on a team is null and void, because from the tape, you can see that I can throw. From what I saw, because he didn't go to the Falcon facility, he decided to film it outside of the high school in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought in his own receivers, which the NFL didn't want him to do. Wow. So it sounded like, to me, it sounded like the NFL wanted this story of Kaepernick to go away. So they decided, we're going to give you a workout. But I also feel like they decided that all these parameters they had around it, in my opinion, they would have spun it and they would have tried to make him look bad. Because when they said, you have to use the receivers that we give you, to me, that's a red flag. Why do they have to be receivers that you pick?
Because there's something fishy about that.
Right, because Kaepernick could throw them the ball and they could purposely drop it. They could run the wrong routes. So Kaepernick said, let me bring in my guys who know me and who know I could do these throws.
Yeah.
I've seen guys who, you know, I've seen online guys who do their workouts, especially quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. They bring in their own receivers, guys they're familiar with. And because, you know, they know. And because it's no different from the NFL. A quarterback only wants the guy catching the ball that he's been able to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows, he knows his tendencies, the receiver knows the quarterback's tendencies.
Yeah, they have like a sort of a connection, like they understand how to play with each other.
Yeah, that's just like if I'm playing basketball and a guy says, hey, I challenge you to basketball, mm-hmm. come and play. But you can only play with the guys I tell you to put on your team. Doesn't make any sense. If I'm playing you, I want my guys that I know. They know my preferences, and I know their preferences on the basketball court. So I'm not about to play with guys that you pick for me. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that was Kaepernick's whole point. So the narrative, the media spun it as Kaepernick doesn't really want to play because he doesn't want to do what the NFL told him to do, and that's the whole thing. The NFL is trying to tell Kaepernick what to do, and Kaepernick feels like, I'm going to do what I feel is right.
Mm-hmm.
And it started from the protest. And I feel like it's ending with this because Roger Goodell came out and said that, you know, basically he's done with it. But Stephen A. Smith is pretty much the face of ESPN. And he's a very famous black journalist.
Mm-hmm. And he has like takes for days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Literally for about 4 days on his show. Because they're Monday through Friday for 4 days, he just kept talking about Kaepernick. Mm-hmm. He brought in legal documents, and he seemed like he was just bashing him over and over again.
Wow.
And, you know, me and my friends were talking about it, and I said, you know, at this point, Stephen A. Smith is the face of ESPN, and ESPN is going to do whatever they can to defend the NFL because mm-hmm. ESPN, you know, signed a huge contract with the NFL years ago That's honestly, the NFL was making ESPN money, especially in the fall. So to me, it was like Stephen A. Smith, he wasn't being honest and truthful. Like, he knows what the NFL was trying to do. The NFL was trying to make Kaepernick look bad. Mm-hmm. But he's going to defend ESPN, which, in case you're defending NFL, mm-hmm. to the core, because, you know, he makes $8 million a year from them.
Damn.
And any journalist on ESPN who goes against the grain ends up not working for the company. Jemele Hill was in the news for calling Trump a white supremacist,
mm-hmm.
and not too soon after she did that, she's no longer on ESPN.
Yeah, it's wild how influential a lot of these commentators are, and it sort of goes back to what we're talking about, the importance of having black sports commentators, you know, singular voices can really shift the momentum of how people feel about teams or individual mm-hmm. players. Like even just looking at different people who make analysis about mixed martial arts, like one person can say that this fighter is a bum, and then that just becomes a narrative that people stick with. Mm-hmm. And it's wild that, like, you know, it might not even be a good take, and that person might not even be the most educated and the most like nuanced thinker within that space, but because they have that platform, like, that just becomes a dominant force. Do you think Stephen A. Smith is at a point where, like, you know, he's doing more harm than good?
with Stephen A. Smith, I think it's two things with Stephen A. Smith. I think it's a generational thing, because he is an older guy. He's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't think he purposely, you know, are trying to make guys look bad, but he is also a guy where his personal feelings get twisted into his professional thing, because a lot of the sports guys that he, you know, that he has on his show, he has personal relationships with. He can call them, he can text them, vice versa. And apparently now Stephen A. Smith is saying that, you know, he's reached out to Kaepernick to try to come on his show, and Kaepernick has turned him down every time. Mm-hmm. So now I'm like, so are you upset at Kaepernick because of the workout, or are you upset at Kaepernick because he refused to come on your show?
Okay.
That's why I feel like things are getting muddled, where, you know, you can't be objective because you want this guy on the show and he possibly told you no. So now is you're going to bash him. It's like, that's not right.
So from your commentating perspective, looking at the sort of entirety of Kaepernick's protest, like, do you think overall it did what it was supposed to do? Do you think that the protest was effective? Do you think that it shifted how, you know, consumers look at the NFL, or how the relationship dynamics are between athletes and sports owners? Like, how do you think those protests actually made an impact, whether positively or negatively?
I think his protests pulled back the curtain a little bit. I think kind of, you know, showed how these owners really feel about the players. That's number one. I also think that his protests, in my opinion, it has inspired a lot of people to speak up. A lot of people are speaking up now on different issues, you know, and are being really vocal. And like I was saying to you earlier, you know, a lot of people that I know in my personal life have gotten into their local politics based off of that. My whole thing with this is, to be realistic, these owners of these teams and organizations, they honestly don't care about, you know, social justice. They don't care about what's going on in these streets. They don't, honestly, in my opinion, a lot of them don't care about the players. What can you do for me is what they care about. So I think for the next generation of athletes coming up, I think with this, a lot of them are more business minded. And I think a lot of them, you know, see that, you know, I may not be able to do what Kaepernick did, but I can still be, you know, a positive force in my community, whether it's giving back, whether it's, you know, scholarship funds and you know, building community centers. And you know, and LeBron James is one person who has gotten a lot of criticism because of, you know, his comments or his lack of comments when it comes to China. But, you know, him opening the school and, you know, just being really charitable is, you know, he gets a lot of praise for. So it's tricky, but I think Kaepernick, I think, changed a lot, and I don't think we're really going to see the effects of his what he did until about 20 years from now. But I think looking back, I think he's going to be that guy who really changed.
Pioneer.
Yeah, how people look at things. I mean, I think back to, you know, the Olympics, you know, the black fists were raised.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those guys were basically literally like social outcasts after that. I believe one of the guys ended up, you know, his marriage broke apart because of that, because it's just the pressure from the outside. But now, you know, they're getting honored. They're getting, you know, all these awards and recognition. Muhammad Ali is another one. You know, for what he did, and, you know, refused to fight in the Vietnam War.
Correct.
You know, He ended up going to jail and losing everything. But what I think the negative for me, not enough guys rallied behind Kaepernick in the NFL. It also showed that when it comes to, millions of dollars, a lot of guys aren't willing to walk away from that, even if they feel like, it's for the right cause.
Yeah, and that's what I think is was tricky, that a lot of these players were in the situation where, they had an opportunity and the platform and the money to really make a difference and really, rally behind them, but at the same time, there's a part of us that sort of understands that, like, okay, for someone who has spent their whole life trying to get to this place, like. And knowing how the NFL treated Kaepernick, there were some folks who were worried that they were going to sort of lose it all. But I think, to your point, I think if they all sort of more collectively stood up, I think it would have been harder for the NFL to be able to do something because there's just so many of them that it wouldn't have been this, oh, this one-off thing. There's a couple of players falling out of line, as opposed to, okay, this is a pervasive issue. A lot of the players are talking about this. We need to go ahead and do something.
Yeah, and to me, it's not really the number of players, it's the status of one or two players. So
Okay.
if one of the quarterback or one of the other quarterbacks, black or white, would have said, you know what, the way they're doing Kaepernick is wrong, I'm not playing this Sunday. If one or two of them would have did that, it would have changed everything. And this is the thing, Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback from the Green Bay Packers, he came out and said, yeah, I think what Kaepernick is standing is kneeling for, I agree with him. I feel like police brutality is a problem, but he still went out and played. But if he would have said, you know what, if until you guys bring back Kaepernick and put him on the team, I'm not playing, it would have changed everything. It would have changed everything.
Yeah, could have just taken one really high profile person to sort of move that domino and start kickstart it.
That's it. I mean, the quarterback is the most important position in the NFL. And, a backup quarterback for, a team that's not doing so well, he's not going to make a bunch of impact. But Aaron Rodgers is one of the faces of the NFL. He's a quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, which is a historic franchise for the NFL. It's a small market team, but it's still like, he's a big name, big face. He's on all these commercials. If he would have said, you know, I'm not gonna play until you all bring him back, he would have changed everything. So unit, like coming together, like, they always say the NFL is a brotherhood and all that stuff, but that's, I'm not buying it.
Yeah,
I'm
push
not
comes
buying
so
it.
shove, the X didn't do it.
Right.
Now, another thing that you're incredibly passionate about, in addition to your lifelong interest in sports, is acting. And you had taken a class. It sort of clicked that this was something that you were really passionate about. How did that transpire? And you mentioned that you're actually an acting coach now. So what's that like?
Well, it's really funny how it all started. I mean, I've always been like big into movies and like a big movie buff. I get that from my mother. My mother loves movies, but I mean, just a big fan of film altogether. And I took the class as just like an elective, something to kind of fill my schedule. And first day of class, my professor said, you know, this is an introduction to dramatic acting. The school, we put on plays, I think it was at that time, it was like two plays for the fall semester and then one for the spring semester. And she said, if you audition for the play and you get a part and you go to all the rehearsals and all the performances, you get an automatic A in my class when you have to show up. So I said, well, that's a good deal. So I went ahead and auditioned. Never done, done a play in my life. But I mean, I just kind of knew, what they will be looking for, what they expect, because I watch movies, go on to stage plays. My younger brother actually started doing stage plays when he was five. So I would watch him.
So you're around that, and
I was around it. Yeah, I know. So I would watch him do plays and stuff, and he was kind of always into it. So I never was that kid. I was my brother is the outgoing, you know, boisterous one. I was always the more like reserved one.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the audition. I got the part, and I mean, I went through all the rehearsals. I had fun, but it was just like more like something to do to get this A in this class.
Mm-hmm.
But opening night, walked out on stage, and my character says a funny line. The whole theater erupted in laughter, and it was just like instantly, like you knew that rush of, you know, a reaction of hearing a whole theater react, get the reaction that you want, that mm-hmm. you've been rehearsing. Mm-hmm. It was just instant. And for me, hearing an audience full of people, you know, laugh at something you say is great. But for me, when I did a dramatic role
mm-hmm.
and hearing people in the audience cry because of a scene that I'm doing and I'm being an emotional and everything, to me, that's the best reaction. Dang. It's like, I'm doing this scene, I'm hitting on my lines and hearing people sniffle, and you know, you can kind of look out in the crowd and you can, you know, kind of see their faces and people are grabbing uh-huh. tissues. It's like, man, that to me, that's the awesome feeling. So being on stage was great. So once I graduated, I just stuck with it, and I did a lot of stage plays around Richmond, and then one of my professors knew a lady who was writing a movie, and he said, there's a part that she has, I think you'll be good for it, but you got to audition, of course. Mm-hmm. Audition, and I got the part, and it was actually a 30-minute short film about Black Wall Street in Richmond, Virginia, which a lot of people don't know about. So mm-hmm. a lot of people know about the Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but there were a number of what they call Black Wall Streets around different states and cities. So Richmond, Virginia had one, and that's what the film was about. So to me, that was great because it was a great role that she had written, and also it had some historical context. And I learned a lot about Richmond, Virginia by doing this, and we went to like a lot of like historic landmarks and the
really like immersing yourself in this.
Yeah, and the area is called Second Street Jackson Ward area in Richmond, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just learning about, you know, some of the first Black millionaires in the United States lived in Richmond, Virginia.
So it's like all these opportunities for you to mm-hmm. not only take these roles, but you know, learn either the history or the backstory of a lot of these roles. And it's like every new role comes a new project and this new opportunity to sort of uncover something, not only just about the story, but about yourself too. Like as someone who does acting and, you know, this is creative work, you know, how would you say you get into the right headspace to do something like this? I mean, to be able to go up on stage, you know, I know for me, I've done speaking events and even just speaking in front of people, like
mm-hmm.
luckily I've done it enough times to where I'm comfortable with it, but obviously acting is a totally different thing. I mean, like, you know, I think the scary thing, The scariest feeling is when you practice something and you're in like a more private environment, and then you mm-hmm. take that out in front of the public and there's like, it's different. There's people there and, mm-hmm. and it's just a completely different energy. How do you get into that space? Do you have any like rituals or routines that you go through to be able to zone in and focus?
For me, To be able to get in the zone, honestly, I can kind of turn it on and turn it off. It was funny. I'm thinking about when we did that play I was saying about when people were in the audience were crying. So the stage managers are right behind the curtain, and I'm on stage, and I'm doing my thing. And so, in that scene, I had to cry myself. So as I'm walking off stage, I'm kind of like, kind of like wiping my face and I'm wiping my tears. I actually made myself cry. And then I get to the green room, I open the door, and then I look up. And I just had this big smile on my face. And all the stage managers, they're in the back. They're like, "You okay?" I'm like, "I'm great." I was like, "Did you hear the audience? They were crying. It's great." And then they're just like, a couple of them got a little bit emotional, and I'm just like, just happy-go-lucky, jolly. So I can turn it on and turn it off. I honestly don't know where I got that from. I think it's just years of just me just watching movies and television. I just kind of just soaked it all up.
Like you know how
But
to just tap into that.
yeah, I just think for me, what helps me get into it depends on the role. So if I'm doing a play or a film that's more upbeat, more of a kind of like a comedy type thing, I just like to listen to, listen to some music, to kind of get my vibe going. But if it's like a more serious role, a more dramatic role, I just like to read, just kind of clear my head as much as I can, and I just try to remember what this character is, what the character's thinking about. Is the
Like tune
character just,
out and
yeah, did they just lose somebody? Are they going through something? Just trying to tap in, and then whichever every character that I play, I try to take one thing that I can say, okay, that reminds me, or I try to look for something that kind of connects me to the character, whether it be, I mean, it could be as simple as, oh, he's from, this area, the area that I'm familiar with,
Okay, so
or
just finding some way to relate.
finding some way to relate, even if it's like the character I played, I was thinking about the film, it took place in, 1929. So I was just trying to think of, well, what's one thing that I can relate to? What's one thing that I can, really, connect with this guy? So I'm just thinking, I'm thinking, I'm thinking, and I'm reading over his character bio and the script, and turns out what she wrote in the play, which happened to be a coincidence, the same school that the character went to is the school that I went to.
No shit.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay, so he's a college student. So I remember what that was like. Actually, we went to the same school. So I'm like, okay, so let me just kind of try to mold it around that. So that kind of helped me with the character, because, just trying to bring any type of relation. And then the play that I was telling you about, where I had, people in the audience crying, that character, he had a kind of sour relationship with his father, which is something that I could relate to. So I just took that and it kind of put my feelings into that character, and kind of did it that way. So, things like that. And it sounds a lot easier when I the way I say it, but it's a lot of work, man. It's
Oh
a lot of
yeah, I mean,
work.
because it's like you have to, it's almost like it's almost as if you have to rewire a part of yourself to like learn how to think a certain way and learn how to like feel a certain way in your skin so that you feel like that character. I'm incredibly enlightened. I mean, you have your experience with acting is incredibly encouraging, and I know that for a lot of people who want to showcase their art and be creative, there's nothing more vulnerable than just doing something and performing on stage. I'd love to go ahead and talk more, but I want to go ahead and make sure people can savor actually listening to what you have to say and listening to a lot of the bright conversations that you have. Unfortunately, I listened to a couple of episodes. You guys have such a high level understanding of the game that I was like, within minutes of hearing the names, I'm like, shit, I don't know what's going on. But where can people find you? And what are some projects that you're working on that some of us can go ahead and keep our eye out for?
So the name of the podcast is the Home Cooking Sports Podcast. We are on Anchor. And we are also on, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. So, Anchor is the main website that we use. So when you go to Anchor, you can, search either Home Cooking, or you can search my name, Ricardo, Ricardo Wolfolk. Last name is spelled Woolfolk. I am working on writing a web series.
Oh.
That's something that I've been wanting to do for such a long time. I've worked with different people, and projects have been w done well and falling through, but I'm working on a web series that I'm putting a lot of my efforts and concentration into it. And hopefully I'll be doing some more plays, but I'm really like, this is one of those things where I feel like I have to do this web series. It's one of those things where it's like it's stuck in my head.
Yeah.
Like I feel like I just have to do it. So that's the next thing I'm working on. Also, our Instagram, Home Cooking Sports. If you could follow us on Instagram. We're also on Facebook, Home Cooking Sports Podcast on there. And yeah, just tune in. Even if you're not a a hardcore sports fan, just tune in. We talk about sports. I would say probably about 80%, but we try to bring in some other things every now and then. But just check us out and spread the word if you like it.
Awesome. Well, Ricardo, thank you so much for joining. I'd love to go ahead and have you come back whenever you have your web series, whenever it's ready to
Oh,
go and promote. We'd love to have you back on.
I think, hey, thank you, man. I really appreciate you having me. I also appreciate you opening up, an avenue for, people with podcasts or persons of color. I really appreciate you and commend you for that. I mean, it's just, it's you'll, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, I think you know that you're doing a great thing, but trust me, like this is really great. And you have a great platform, growing. I've been following you for years, and for you to just to kind of open up some room that other people shine. It takes somebody with a great heart to do that, because a lot of people won't. And I really do appreciate you.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. I mean, for me, it's like I got here because of how passionate and how committed a lot of people in the community are. And for me, I realize how hard it is to build a platform and how hard it is to get people to follow you and to care about what you have to say. And sometimes it's pure accident that you make it and others and someone else doesn't. And sometimes that all it takes is just that one appearance on something where you're like, damn, I heard this person while I was listening to this podcast or when I was on that YouTube channel. So I'm hoping to, give people this spotlight so, more people can find out about you all. All
Oh, thank you, man. Appreciate it. I really do.
right, Ricardo, have a nice night.
All right, you too.
All right, take care.
All right.
Thank you for listening to another installment of Lag Radio. Lag Radio is an independently produced podcast recorded and edited here in my home office, so I appreciate any and all support. Whether you share this podcast with your friends on social media or sign on to become a sponsor, there are plenty of ways that you can help out. Speaking of which, if you're a small business owner or a person of color who wants to promote your platform, business, or brand, contact me and you can become a sponsor of Lag Radio. We'll have you sponsor some of our episodes, and you can even join on to be a guest of the show. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes, you can find Lag Radio on anchor.fm/lagradio, or you can listen on any major podcasting app like Google, Spotify, or Apple.